Welcome to the 44th episode of Investment Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chatt.
Welcome to the podcast where we're not going to let the threat of nuclear war distract us from the start of the county cricket season.
And so this episode, we are going to be talking about that county season, and also about the small matter of the 2020 cricket that you might have noticed has been taking over the globe of late. We're going to be celebrating Wisden at 150, and we're going to be reviewing Rahul Bhattacharya's pundits from Pakistan, as well as having one of our typical raucous debates. So what has been distracting you from the threat of nuclear war over the last couple of weeks?
Well, it's become a start of season tradition over the last few years that you get to April and you moan about the IPL. That's what any good English loving cricket fan should do.
Any good podcast. And
yeah, and you think, and actually, I was looking at our preparation for this podcast, and I was getting ready for a good rant, and I actually found myself watching a bit of IPL cricket. I found myself being lured in. And there's plenty wrong with it. There are far, far too many games. I mean, a disgusting amount of games. They just keep coming.
There was quite a good description. I can't remember who it was, but someone who said that it's like eating a kind of a Big Mac watching a 2020 match. And the IPL is like someone kind of pinning you down and just shoving Big Mac after Big Mac into your mouth until you can take it.
What's more concerning is they tell you with each game what number game it is. And you're like, the tournament's only been going 3 days. It's like game number 15. It's gone too many games. And yes, bank maximums are annoying, and I really don't care who wins. I haven't built an affinity to a team. All that being said, I've dipped in and found some compelling cricket. I watched the back end of Virat Kohli's astonishing 92 off 47 balls. You know, not a slog in sight, beautiful driving. Some really intriguing individual matchups that you get by mixing these cricketers into odd teams. Dwayne Bravo, Kieran Pollard, this incredibly hostile standoff they had, fantastic to watch. And I challenge any cricket fan not to be excited by the sight of Sachin Tendulkar and Ricky Ponting opening the batting together. In my opinion, this isn't a tournament, it's an exhibition. I don't care who wins. You know, it's far too long to really be a tournament. I mean, most of the games don't really almost matter till a much later stage. That being said, there's a lot to enjoy, there's a lot to watch. And why not, you know, have your cake and eat it, get a bit of IPL, get a bit of county cricket, which I'm sure you've been doing.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying about the number of games that go on in the IPL, because actually, I think county cricket can get a little bit like that after a time, because when you have an entire summer full of games, sometimes you kind of go onto Crick Info and it's sort of, you know, you have to scroll through six or seven scorecards and you kind of sort of lose track of what's happening sometimes. And one of the things...
Well, the killer thing in county cricket is the schedule as well, isn't it? You just think, got a game starting today. And to be fair, they are trying to address that, but it's erraticness of like, why is this game starting on a Tuesday? Why is it, you know, is to care
as all the games this week, which started on a Wednesday, the whole season. But one thing that I think... has been a good new development this season has been Crick Info's new County Cricket Live blog. One of the problems in the past, I think, has been that you go onto the BBC website or the Guardian website or the Crick Info website and you have to scroll through about six different scorecards and everything sort of gets a bit disjointed and you don't really get a picture of what's happening across the board at any one time. But what the new Crick Info blog has done is brought together all of the games happening at the same time, and you get kind of bite-sized updates from all of them. And actually, it's Crick Info going a bit towards the Guardian model, so they're going away from the very, very sort of formal ball-by-ball type commentary and a little bit towards the Guardian one, which is to say it doesn't go ball-by-ball, but it picks up key highlights.
And crucially, they are committing people to the grounds. I mean, I think Crick Info has done cricket extraordinary service in so many ways, and I think this is a great example of them. I mean, I mentioned in a previous podcast the BBC deal that they've done. I've been listening to some of their commentary this week. That's been great as well. So from high points, the excitement of the IPL, the excitement of county cricket, to a couple of low points, and to a tournament that you have labelled a farce.
Well, maybe a farce is a bit strong, but I mean, in the light of we were talking about the proposed World Test Championship a couple of episodes ago, and talking about the fact that it's not really going to mean anything, and you can't really get an excitement. I mean, it's the problem with any ICC tournament of late that they just make it too long. The ICC Intercontinental Cup, talking of tournaments that are too long, it takes place over 2 years, which I think this is the first time that it's not taken place within a sort of single season. The idea of it is to provide a springboard for teams which are associate nations, a springboard for them to play four-day cricket against, I think it's four rather than five-day cricket, against one another, and then be able to kind of make the transition up to test status. It's never worked. No one who's ever played in the ICC Intercontinental Cup has ever moved up. And I just wonder whether it's the best, by kind of labelling it as a tournament, you kind of put certain expectations around the excitement of it and that kind of thing, but by then putting it over 2 years, you start sort of start getting matches that start meaning very, very little in the context of
you could, like, an alternative model that would be quite interesting is actually just have it a B or C tier of Test cricket, where actually, you know, Ireland do go and play a series against the Netherlands, you know, something like that. I mean, I think this is all part of a much bigger question of how do you get associated in Test cricket, and that's a complicated issue.
I think the idea of series is really, really important, because the ICC seems to, and actually world cricket in general seems to be moving a little bit, or have moved in the past, I think it's stopped now, away from the idea of playing series. And so we had some ludicrous, you know, Australia, South Africa, where you just think that is crying out to be a five-test series.
You know, I think an Ireland-Afghanistan series would be fantastic for both of those two countries, fantastic for their development.
Where have you been? Where have you been looking?
There's been this splurge, and it continues to grow now, of every country needs its own IPL on whatever scale it is. And I moaned earlier in the year about the BPL, the Bangladeshi Premier League. There's just no purpose to it. You know, there just is not a need for another 20. But I thought one argument you could have for it is that at least local players will benefit. They'll get cricket against high-profile players. They'll get well-paid. Well, they're not getting well-paid, because it's emerged that the BPL have paid the international cricketers, the OA Shahs and the Chris Gayles who turned up and played. They've been paid. A lot of the international cricketers, a lot of the local players haven't been paid yet. They're well behind schedule. It's just a bit miserable. And you feel that it's a good example of a league just overstretching itself.
And there's a big difference, I think, between where in India it can be used as a genuine form of developing your players, saying that you have to have there's a minimum number of Indian players that you have. There's a difference between that and just getting in local players effectively just to make up the numbers.
From the archives. Now, there are few things more satisfying for a cricket fan than the sight of the beautiful yellow spine of Wisden on their shelves. And this year is the 150th anniversary of that esteemed publication. And Toby's taken the chance to have a look at, well, where does Wisden fit in the grand, chaotic, evolving world of modern cricket?
Wisden has, I think, been omnipresent in the lives of, well, every cricket lover for the last 150 years that it's been in existence. I remember when I was growing up playing cricket, aged 6, 7, at the spines in the pavilion, and getting given it every year for my birthday.
You open it for the first time, and it's it's so ridiculous that there is so much. It's just this kind of cornucopia. Mm. You open it for the first time and just so excited. You know, where do you start?
And I always sort of assumed that it was a bit like the MCC. That it was the sort of authoritative voice on the game, that it was a bastion of tradition that was always holding out against, you know, the upstarts in the IPL and everything like that. But actually, come its 150th anniversary, I've been having a bit of a rethink and some thoughts about really what Wisden has done for the game. In 2003, they decided to replace the beautiful Eric Pavilius print that they always had, or wood print that they always had on the front, with a photograph of a cricketer for the first time, and that was Michael Vaughan. And Ian Woolrich in the Daily Mail described it as being, quote, scarcely less heretical than slapping a picture of Judas Iscariot on future editions of the Holy Bible. And quite apart from his ridiculous rhetoric, it sort of shows the feelings people have about Wisden as a publication.
It's, I mean, the comparison with the Bible to me makes so much sense, because it is seen in that way by so many people.
It is
this holy tome
as being the Bible of cricket. But actually, I think Wisden has always been and continues to be actually quite radical, and not just in the sense of putting photographs instead of wood prints on the front. But when it was set up in 1864, it was set up as a direct challenge to what was then seen as sort of being the Bible of cricket, which was a book called The Guide to Cricket by Fred Lillywhite. And this was a book that was very much in the sort of Victorian tutorial mode, and Lily White sort of set out what the rules of the game were, and tellingly what he described as, quote, full direction for playing the noble and manly game of cricket.
Well, here
was him saying that there is an idea, a central idea of what cricket is, and people should learn it, and people should adhere to it. And in response to this, John Wisden set up something which was actually much more, in a sense, akin to a newspaper. Whereas Lily White was very autocratic, Wisden was essentially democratic. And that continues to this day, in the sense that, yes, you have an editor who's very influential. I think there have only been, I mean, it's remarkable that I think there have been... Excuse me, I think there have been 17 editors in the last 150 years. And there's this kind of great tradition of the editors and what they've brought to it. But underneath that, like with any good newspapers, they've actually brought in voices from all over the place to actually create debate and disagreement and opinion around the game, rather than saying... So the Bible of cricket was no longer the idea of a central tome with rules in it. Mm. It was a debate. And actually, I think that is something which has created the kind of culture.
It's interesting because I suppose it's got both, hasn't it? Because it's got the definitive side to it, hasn't it? It's got the account of games and it's got the rules and stuff. But you're right, it has got this almost like the best of the best angle, where I get the impression the editor just goes out and says, who are the great writers of the moment? And we will just get them in.
I mean, it's brilliant. So I work in music, and I've always thought that the person who gets the programme, the BBC Proms that happen every summer, is just has the best job in the world, because he can invite any orchestra to play anything and they'll just immediately say yes. And it's the same with Wisden. You just invite anyone to write anything and you know that they're going to come and say yes to it. And I think it was quite telling that in this this year's edition, the kind of lambasting of Kevin Peterson's behaviour that has made the headlines off the back of it, that's not something which, you know, I'm sure the MCC spend their entire time disagreeing with Kevin Peterson and disapproving of him. But their gumption to come out and say, actually, our role is not just to put statistics out into the world, but is actually to create debate.
The editor of Wisden has power in those notes, doesn't he? You know, the editor's note in Wisden is enough to top cricket news stories. You know, it does have influence. It is sort of, you know, it's read in a way, and it's taken seriously in a way that, you know, your average journalist wouldn't be.
I think the other thing that you touched on earlier, which is really important about Wisden, is just simply the scale of its ambition. The fact that it combines both the statistics and also the opinion pieces, but also that both sides of things are so absolutely exhaustive. And it does have a focus on English cricket, but nowhere else in the entire world are you going to see the top scorers of the kind of English public schools sitting side by side with the top scorers of the IPL.
The interesting thing is that whereas a lot of reference books, which Wisden isn't, and I think we've just concluded that, have really sort of been killed by the rise of the internet, or become, you know, I've read things like Who's Who, that used to be a kind of definitive, you must own this book, have become a lot less so because of the internet. Wisden seems to be doing actually quite a good job in evolving in such a way, and maybe it's just tradition, maybe people still feel like they have to have it on their shelf.
Well, I suppose it's interesting because Crick Info is the obvious. I mean, Wisden is the most important, most popular, most sold annual book on a particular sport in the world, and Crick Info is the most visited single sport website in the entire world, and I'm wondering whether there's something about cricket that sort of lends itself to this sort of scale.
Definitive, yeah.
But I think what's really interesting about Wisden is that its attitude that the entirety of world cricket can sit together in the same place, whether it's school cricket in England or the IPL, is something that has, in a sense, has actually led to the massive sense of globalisation that we've got at the moment, that people, you know, are able to go and play in, you know, county players go off and play in whatever the league is called in Australia, the Big Bash League. I'm not up on my Australian T20 league names. So it's that sense. But actually, I think there's always something for me quite reassuring that ultimately all of these players sit side by side within the same book. That it's not, we don't have a big, Wisden provides a kind of bastion against the sense that we have this sort of fragmented cricket where the IPL sort of going off on one and county cricket something completely different. It brings it all back together and says, this is cricket, this is a picture of world cricket as we know it. ¶¶
both of you, and we have spent a very happy couple of weeks reading Rahul Bhattacharya's Pundits from Pakistan. It was published in 2005, and it's an account of the 2003-04 India tour of Pakistan, which came at a time of great both cricketing and political significance, I think. They hadn't played cricket against each other for a while, and as nations, it's, I think it's fair to say that they weren't on the
friendliest
terms. Huge
amount of tension in the run-up.
Exactly. And there's quite a telling quotation from George Orwell early on in the book, which I think says quite a lot about both the structure and sort of the point of the book, and it's this. Orwell says that that sport was effectively mimic warfare. It was an unfailing cause of ill will, and it was bound up with hatred, jealousy, boastfulness, disregard of all rules, and sadistic pleasure in witnessing violence. Do you think this book bears that out?
Well, this book is a riposte to that. It's an argument that whereas a lot of people feared that India touring Pakistan would be an opportunity for just that, mimic warfare, an opportunity to rouse up violence and aggression.
Literal warfare as well.
Perhaps.
When you read about some of the security that was
extraordinary. But instead, the book shows that the series was anything but. It created these extraordinary moments where two populations who had, in a lot of cases, been driven by propaganda to feel a sort of hatred to each other, the relationship between the supporters at the ground were extraordinary. I mean, some of the banners and things that are being unveiled, and so, you know, really beautiful kind of messages of peace and cooperation. And two nations with so much political baggage between them united around a shared passion, and it did exactly the opposite. Bhattacharya would never argue, I'm sure, that cricket could be the solution to the crisis, but it was still a wonderful opportunity for two opposed nations to at least meet and coincide over something.
One of the, I think, very significant things about the book is that it doesn't lose sight of the cricket in among talking about this sort of political situation. And actually, it's one of the things that I think is quite telling about why the series works, both politically and cricketing-wise, which is that the cricket was just so compelling. I have to confess that I'd actually kind of slightly forgotten about this series. And two things. Firstly, the match reports contained in this book are absolutely gripping.
Well, his writing style is fantastic, but you're also right that he had wonderful material to work with. You know, could always write these matches by fiction.
I went away and watched again. All of the highlights are on YouTube. I went away and watched them again. And
there was a very good article recently that said, actually, we shouldn't bemoan the loss of county cricket match reports because they're no good anymore. You know, they're just sterile descriptions of what happened. And what's brilliant about Bhattacharya, there is nothing sterile about any of these descriptions. I mean, he reminded me of just how effective a great simile or metaphor is for bringing a game to life. I mean, try this. VVS Laxman batting. Laxman poked, missed, bent over, and generally responded like a man at whom knives were being hurled. It's genius. And it's over the top.
It's interesting. In the inside front cover of the book, they quote Mike Marcuse, reviewing the book for Wisden Asia Cricket, who says, "Forget about the DVD highlights package. If you want to relive the tour in all its dramatic complexity, read Bhattacharya." Actually, one of the things I think is really good about it is that it actually brings the players to life as people, because particularly on a series like this, when you're watching the highlights, when you're kind of following it in the match reports, the sort of the Crick Info match reports, it becomes a bit sort of statistical. But what Bhattacharya I think does really well is shows how, even for the players, this was such a significant tour, and they sort of realised that they were part of something.
You warm to a few of the personalities involved. I've certainly found myself warming to Shoaib Akhtar, and I think one thing I think I appreciated, both in terms of the match report and the game as well, is that appreciation that one of the things we find cricket compelling about cricket is that it's a mess of characters who all do things slightly individually. I mean, going back to Shoaib Akhtar, this match report, Shoaib pounded in from 40 yards, bosom heaving, thighs bulging, nostrils dilating, a bawdiness beyond redemption. I mean, that's where I'd agree with Marcuse's point. I mean, description far better than watching it. And it's the appreciation that actually no fast bowler is quite the same. You know, and to really appreciate cricket is to see that and to enjoy that.
One of the things that struck me about the book is that, yes, it's obviously based on facts and recent facts, but there are times when, to me, it read a little bit like a novel. We reviewed Shyam Karunatilaka's Chinaman a few weeks ago, where he's kind of searching for a lost cricketer, and it's kind of mostly fictional with a little bit of fact thrown in on the side. And there are bits in Pundits from Pakistan in Bhattacharya where he goes off, for instance, and he meets a young cricketer who was picked by Imran Khan to be part of the
Akib Javid, I think.
Akib Javid, yeah. And he was picked as a kind of 15-year-old to go and play internationally, and then got bored aged, you know, took a whole hat load of wickets, and then got bored aged 25 and went off and ran a fish farm or something like that. And it's just those little details that you kind of get. You get the sense that he, Bhattacharya, thinks that his remit isn't just to go along and kind of.
Well, he's a great interviewer as well. I mean, the information he gets out of Javid about, you know, the art of reverse swing, about why Pakistan, you know, is a very probing interview. Which is why, actually, maybe one of the things that's so good about this book is if you pin it down, it's quite hard to pin down. I mean, it's a collection of great match reports, it's a collection of great interviews, it's also a part travel log. I mean,
yep,
parts of
exactly.
Pakistan, I suddenly thought, you know, sounded what rather wonderful. There's also some wonderful bits of just good old-fashioned, like, analysis of a sports journalist just working hard and telling you stuff that you wouldn't obviously see. There's a wonderful defense of Sachin Tendulkar when Tendulkar's accused of batting selfishly for a double hundred. In the end, Dravid declares and leaves him stranded in 196. And Bhattacharya brilliantly aligns the fact. He looks at Tendulkar's rate of scoring. He looks at the context of the game. And you just think that this is really, when you read these sort of, you know, very slim journalistic articles that are based on opinion and nothing, you think, well, this is what sports journalism should be. You know, tell me something I don't know. Analyse the facts.
Yeah, I mean, Bhattacharya is quite clearly very, very knowledgeable about cricket, as he is about many things. But what's wonderful is that he wears that knowledge quite lightly. And so you don't get the sense of someone who's just sitting there kind of providing incessant analysis into the game, that it is kind of padded out into a more holistic picture that brings in personalities,
well, because he morphs,
and cultures.
But you're right, because what's so good is that if you take a book like this with a lot of different elements, it risks becoming a mess, but yet things just work really well. You know, you get a match report at the right time, you then get an interview at the time you want that. It's a beautifully structured book.
It is. It's a narrative that kind of follows the ebbs and flows of the tour and actually uses that to its advantage, I think.
And finally, to the debate. Now, recently, Sanath Jayasuriya, now a selector with Sri Lanka, picked Ramith Rambukwela, a player with barely any sort of first-class background, not a very impressive average. And defending the player, he said, "We don't just bring in players who perform, we also bring in players with talent." And it's really got me thinking along the lines of, is it possible to spot talent, to select on talent, even when performance isn't there?
The question, I think, is whether talent and performance are actually different things. Because how do you know that someone's got talent if they've never performed? I mean, I might have bags of talent. I've just never been put on a test match, you know, into Lords against an Australian bowling lineup on the first day of the Ashes. And it seems to me to be slightly short-sighted to say, just because, you know, I've seen someone once play a nice cover drive in the nets, that therefore they've got talent, well, and actually being able to perform is something completely separate. Because actually, I mean, this whole debate about Ian Bell, everyone's saying he's incredibly talented, it's just he can't perform. Well, surely the talent that he needs is to score runs in test matches, and he's not talented in the right way if he can't.
I would agree with you that ultimately greatness is achieved through performance. You perform regularly and consistently, and I think the debate, I mean, Ian Bell has, I think, now performed, but I think the debate always with Ian Bell was almost this cliche that would go around with cricket fans: he's the most talented batsman in the England side, doesn't always deliver. And I thought that made perfect sense, because he clearly had the talent, he clearly had the gift of playing all these wonderful drives, he had the time, he had everything, and couldn't translate that into performance. And I think they are separate things at the end of the day. Talent is something you can have. Whether you translate it always into performance, I think, is something slightly
different. Surely the... and I realise that we risk here just kind of descending into a massive argument about semantics, effectively. But surely there's... Yes, you can have a talent for playing a cover drive, but actually being able to perform on the big stage is in itself a particular talent. Being able to, under pressure, put together a decent innings is a talent.
Well, I think maybe then you could distinguish in cricket, between the fact that, I mean, I remember reading an interesting piece that said the dream cricketer will be Alistair Cook's mentality and Ian Bell's shot making skills.
It would be Ian Cook. It
would be Ian Cook. And I think that's an interesting point you made, that actually potentially you've got to understand them as separate talents, separate abilities.
Yeah, exactly.
But I wonder, let's take it back to this issue of just, can you select almost based on talent? And I was thinking actually recently, Mohammed Amir. So, we're having red punts from Pakistan today. We know Pakistan quite happy often to bring very young players into the squad. I mean, Mohammed Amir brought in to make his test debut when he was 17. That's a clear example of a player being picked on raw talent. And what, you know, happened down the line along, you know, it worked, didn't it?
Or is it being picked in order to... you know, in order to develop them, you bring them into the team. You put them into that culture early, and then it's for the long term unless they end up doing a bit of spot fixing. Similarly, actually, I think quite a good example is of in rugby for the British Lions. Occasionally, it predominantly picks from people who play for their country regularly, but occasionally you get club players who aren't selected for their country who are just catapulted into the Lions. And the reason for that is that they've actually been able to perform for their... They don't just say, OK, we've never seen you play. We think you might vaguely be good. The reason Mohammed Amir was picked is because he was taking wickets. It wasn't just because someone once saw him bowl the ball.
But what Mohammed Amir didn't have, age 17, is a ridiculous track record of first-class performance. He just didn't. You know, he was not an age where that was possible. What he did have was a clear ability that Pakistani selectors were willing to gamble on. Yeah, and it maybe reflects on something quite interesting, that because you could not imagine really a comparative thing being done in England. I mean, to give an example, sort of ultimate opposite of the scale, think Nick Compton. Mm. I mean, Nick Compton is someone who has been chosen, and I think he's doing a good job, I hope he keeps his place for the Ashes, but he's someone who's been chosen entirely based on a track record of years and years of solid performance, and particularly one outstanding year of county performance.
That comes off the back of being able, of having some talent. You don't build up years and years of a solid track record of performance if you don't have talent.
No, I'm not.
I still think it's a red herring to be distinguishing between the two in this way.
No, I think it's possible to select someone. I think it's possible to gamble in selection. And I'm not saying this gamble always work, but I'm saying that it is possible to... And I think some test nations would have a different attitude to that. It's possible to sort of talent scout in such a way that maybe you take a gamble on someone who hasn't got this track record, who hasn't got years of performance behind them. Or even months of performance behind them.
Going back to this Jai Sarir quote, saying... We don't just bring in players who perform, we also bring in players with talent. So you don't actually care if they perform on that. As long as they've got bags of talent, you don't really care if they make any runs.
Well, I think...
Because that's effectively what he's saying. He's saying as long as they're able to play a flashy cover drive in the net, surely the bottom line has to be, when you put them on the pitch, they need to be able to score runs if they're a batsman. That is it, end off.
Well,
Ian Bell would not be in the team if he didn't occasionally...
And the Ian Bell debate, I think, is a historic example. It's no longer relevant anymore because I think he has performed probably over time sufficiently to earn that place. But I think what was interesting, England persevered with him for a while when they probably would not have persevered with other batsmen who performed at that level.
That's
and talent gave him
perform.
The chance, but talent kept him relevant. Like,
But the end goal was that he was going to end up performing. If we're going to take this distinction that Jai Sarir has, ultimately they weren't keeping him there because they said, you're really talented and you can carry on being talented but not performing. They kept him there because they said, okay, you, at the moment you're not scoring the runs. We think one day you're going to be scoring the runs, but ultimately the bottom line is eventually you need to perform, otherwise you're not
going to be agreed. So the long-term goal is always got to be performance, but the actual criteria of selection can, on occasion, be talent.
Agreed. Thank you for listening to the 44th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. We were very interested to read all your tweets from the last episode, telling us where you disagreed with us and what you thought about all kinds of things. Do keep them coming. We're over at Reverse Swept on Twitter. We've got a website on the way, although I've been saying that for the last 2.5 years. But when that's up and running, you'll be able to listen to individual sections of the podcast. And we'll be with you again in another 3 weeks to talk about all the latest.